last words of the Buddha as recorded in the Mahapranayana Sutta, where Dhamma Sankhara Apamadena Sampadeta. And I find one of the most astonishing of the Buddha's teachings that he managed to sum up his whole message, his whole life's work in just four words. Vaya Dhamma Sankhara. Conditioned phenomena are subject to deterioration. Pamadena Sampadeta. Strive on with diligence. Or in the more colloquial version, things fall apart. Keep trying. Things fall apart, keep trying. The other last words that I really like is the last words of Oscar Wilde, who said, either this wallpaper goes or I do. Now, you have to admit that's fairly cool last words, isn't it? Laughing in the face of death. Either this wallpaper goes or I do. The irony of it is, of course, that he went, the wallpaper stayed. Which tells us something interesting about death, doesn't it? Death actually doesn't care if we laugh at him. He'll kill you anyway. Death doesn't care whether you deny him or accept him. He'll just kill you anyway. He doesn't care whether you think about him or understand him. He's just going to kill you anyway. Death doesn't care whether your life's been lived heedfully or negligently. He's just going to kill you anyway. That's the thing about death. He's very single-minded. He's very focused. He gets the job done. He would make a very good capitalist. Some would say that he already does make a very good capitalist, but that's beside the point here. And it's in the face of this grinding inexorability of death that we live our tiny, tiny, tiny little lives. The image that the Buddha uses in the suttas talking to King Pasenadi said, like, there are four mountains, one in the north, one in the south, one in the east, one in the west. And these mountains were moving, converging, and there you are in the middle. Just waiting with these mountains crushing all before them. One of the most marvelous things, the greatest gifts of our age, our generation, is that we are for the first time able to see pictures of our planet. A beautiful blue planet Earth in space. In the past, generations had no real conception or image of this, just maybe an idea. Even in Buddhism, had a notion of vast complexes of world systems, but if you look at how that's described in the Visuddhimagga, talks about the world systems being laid next to one another like plates. So it's like a two-dimensional image, an image of the world systems crowded up against each other. And now we know that things are not really like that. They're much stranger. They're much more unnerving. And you see this blue pearl sitting in space, the color of it, the vividness of it, caused by life. Our planet, our land, our oceans, our air, and the world to coexist in a very complex living system called Gaia. From space we can see this wholeness, and yet that biosphere on the planet Earth is really just like wallpaper, isn't it? It's a tiny, thin, little layer of mold and fungi and things that have evolved a bit from mold and fungi. Spread very thinly over the surface of the earth, like very thin scraping Vegemite of a thick slice of bread. And as our eye is attracted to this most beautiful of all images, the perfection and the beauty of the earth in space, we're drawn to that comforting, nurturing home which has been our cradle and which will also be our grave. We are distracted from and tend to ignore, hide away in the basement of our subconscious, the fact that this blue pearl is floating in an endless, endless sea of black nothing. Then we go into our mind and contemplate our perspective, the shape of our awareness as we experience it in meditation. It's a little bit like that too, isn't it? It's a little bit like a lamp on a dark night that illuminates a certain area around us, and beyond that, nothing. This is an image that the Platonic philosophers used for God, as adopted by some of the Catholic theologians. The idea that God is like a bright light in the darkness, and that that light is the light of being. And as one moves further away from that light, being or reality becomes attenuated, the darkness grows. And this is what we call evil. So according to this way of thinking, evil has no independent or objective reality. Simply the absence of light. And there's no doubt that that darkness is in fact what we call evil or suffering. And this is where our fears lurk. The fear of the unknown, the fear of the darkness, the fear, and you come right down to it, of death. Our lives are lived in this short span before we are born. There's darkness, there's ignorance, we don't know. Maybe we're born with with some memory, some idea of what happened before, but for the most part, we lose that. For most people, have nothing more, and most people have no idea at all of any past before this. And if they do, the knowledge is dim, confused, and fades quickly. Only a few can penetrate that. And then after our death, again, the veil is drawn, the curtain falls, and we are left to populate that space with the creatures of our imagination. And we're sitting watching the play, being distracted by the show, knowing that lurking in the back of the mind is the knowing that this is all going to end. It's all going to come to an end sometime. And the very curious thing is that part of us is fearful, and yet at the same time part of us longs for that release. This was, so far as I know, first articulated maybe 1,000 or 2,000 years before the Buddha, in the Egyptian pyramid texts, as the saying, death lies before me today, like the home that a man longs to see after years spent as a captain. So here we live in the light with fear that death, that dissolution, and yet at the same time we yearn for it. When I was staying in my cave in Malaysia, in Ipoh, one time the supporters came and we were talking, and they said to me, "Don't you get lonely staying here by yourself?" And I said, "I only ever get lonely when I'm with other people." And I meant that as a perfectly straightforward statement, and for some reason I'm not, still not quite sure, but they thought it was hilarious and killed themselves laughing. Well, I didn't quite get the joke. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of being with people. Maybe you're at a party, social gathering, people have come for no other reason than to be there with other people, to chat, to drink, to dance, and then there's this feeling of receding or vanishing when the memory of existence, the knowledge of the truth, hits you like a kick in the gut. You feel like you double over and fall down on the floor. You just can't cope anymore. You curl up there, knowing that all of this is going to end. Knowing that none of it has any meaning. Knowing that you're just dropping down into this abyss. And all the people around you keep chatting and laughing, and there's nothing stopping you from calling out to them, but you don't. You're never that close anyway. When the mind wants to see or know the truth like that, it has its own solidity. It appears not just as a concept in the mind, but as a physical entity inside the body. moves you, constricts you, it impacts you, and you realize that as a human, as a biological, sentient, conscious organism, we are an object, a physical object that moves in time and in space. Our relationship with other people is mediated through our ability to manipulate the physicality of our environment. Our identity is coextensive with this body. It ends with our skin. We desperately try to cling on to this sense of identity, even though these boundaries are constantly being transgressed. They leak. The perception of the solidity, our solidity, only applies at a certain scale. If we look down a powerful microscope, we see that what we take to be solidity is nothing more than energies, patterns of energy moving in space. And if we expand our scale the other direction, move back from the planet Earth out into the galaxy, very quickly the Earth recedes and becomes nothing, less than a fly speck, an obscure planet circling a third-rate sun in a forgotten arm of an unexceptional galaxy, in cosmic terms, beyond the black stump. And it's only by keeping our frame of reference, reassuring the mediocre, do we manage to stop our consciousness from sliding into these voids. The familiar solidity of physical objects reassures us, makes us feel okay. It's the wallpaper we surround ourselves with. It's like the story of the Buddha's early life. One of the most astonishing things about it is the quality it has of receding and of being flimsy. The Buddha's mother is called Maya, means magic trick, illusion. She goes into the Garden of Lumbini to play. birth of the Buddha, the play of illusion. Wife is called Bimba, means puppet. His life is surrounded by surfaces of things. He's hidden from the truth. His father makes, as it were, a glamour, a wallpaper that masks. I saw this when I was in Bodh Gaya last year, and the president of India arrived, and they made 20 kilometers from the airport at Gaya to the site of Bodh Gaya. They put 20 kilometers of cloth curtains as a corridor along the roads, so that when the president drove along all the roads, she couldn't see the poverty. She couldn't see the fields filled with human excrement. She couldn't see the decades worth of rubbish piled up, the decaying buildings, the lepers. She just saw these curtains of white cloth. When we see a play or watch a movie, we see an image in front of us that moves, and we have to pretend, we have to participate in the pretense that it's real. We willingly suspend what we know to be the truth in order to engage in falsehood. And yet the emotions, the insights, the truths that are conveyed through that medium are just as true, perhaps even more so. Plato didn't get this. Plato thought that art was inferior because it was just an imitation of reality. But our life is lived in this participation in this illusion. We know that it's curtains, we know that it's wallpaper, and we commune. As David Hume described it, we forget, no matter how much our insight tells us that this is illusion, we're guaranteed, according to David Hume, he said we're guaranteed that within a few minutes we'd completely forget the reality and we would live our life continuing to collude in the illusion. And in terms of ordinary people and ordinary consciousness, what David Hume said was perfectly correct. This is why that insight in Buddhism is paired with the development of meditation, the development of sati, which is precisely that continual recollection and awareness, so that we don't forget and we maintain that awareness of what it's like to see through the veil. So as we are moving through our lives, we step upon the ground as if it were solid, as if it were trustworthy. We can never go beyond the surfaces of things. When we scratch the surface, all we find is new surfaces. We can never know whether there is anything other than surface. We think we can cut through and find the reality at the heart, but the reality is just the surface of reality. Remember, like the Wile E. Coyote, who's always tricked and ends up standing in thin air at the top of the cliff, and it always takes a few seconds before he realizes that he's only standing on the air, not standing on the ground. And as soon as he realizes the ground's not there, he falls down. There's something about the nature of life and the nature of experience which makes it hard to bear. This is the literal rendering, or one of the literal renderings of the Pali word dukkha. Dukkha is hard to bear. Can't stand it. This is what dukkha means. Can't stand it, but can't make it go away. There's nothing you can do. It does seem peculiar, doesn't it, after all these years of evolution, and we still experience such great pain. Surely evolution could have figured out a better way of doing it. Like an off button you can have. Okay. Don't need to keep on hurting me now, I've got the message. Switch it off. The pain keeps coming. Keeping this whole thing going, this whole complex system, our body wrapped in skin, inside fat, grease, ligaments, bone, all the little funny bits of gristle and nodules of things, organs, bone marrow, all of these things tying together in this extraordinary, flexible, malleable, rotting object. Every second as we sit here, and death comes a little bit closer. Every second as we sit here, our body's burning up fuel. The cells working to sustain themselves, replicate themselves, build tissue to replace the decaying and broken tissue. And it's all going to fail. We're going to die one day. We hope for a painless and dignified death. And that is just the fear of pain, the fear of the indignity of the dying process. We maybe have a belief, a faith about what comes after. And yet in our heart of hearts we have to admit we don't really know. When we undertake our spiritual practice in Buddhism, we have a longing for cessation. We cultivate within ourselves an appreciation of the peacefulness of the ending of things. We meditate, feelings end, thoughts end, activity ends, and we're peaceful. Our Dhamma aspiration, our Chanda, yearns to fulfill that, to complete that process. It's not always easy to distinguish this from the yearning for death. Yeah, these two things are dangerously close. In the hands of one too little wisdom, it is very easy for the teachings of the Dhamma and the tools of the Dhamma to be misused, to turn into the tools of annihilation. Of course, according to Buddhism, death does not provide actual peace. Death is just a staging post, a movement on into the unknown. When we start to take Dhamma teaching seriously and to move our lives, to orient our lives consciously towards Nibbana, or with the values of our life. Question: they're turned upside down. We find some way to be fully authentic to this realization, this intuitive understanding of the true depth of our existential aloneness and emptiness. And reconcile this with life. We become, when we ordain, we become as one who's died. We wear the robes and shaven head of a corpse in ancient India. The ordination ceremony, like all change of life ceremonies, is a symbol of death and rebirth. The authentically lived life of the samana in the Buddhist religion is the life constantly conscious of mortality, of futility, of pointlessness. It's only when we can make this vivid and real to ourselves constantly, every day, every moment, that we begin to live authentically in the life of the Dhamma. So this is my little talk for you this evening on wallpaper. Anyone have any comments or questions? Let's finish my things.
Satipanna